whether we're reflecting on our personal life or on our life in the workplace. One of a leader's responsibilities is to make sense of things for their followers. As sense-makers, leaders help those around them understand how their contributions fit into the organization's accomplishments. They help them appreciate how they matter. The best leaders do this deliberately, and the very best do it often. It's worth noting that the responsibility to make it matter is shared by leader and follower. Each of us should recognize that our life can and should matter. Each of us should embrace the fact that we can make a difference, sometimes in big ways, more often in small ways, so that the aggregate of our lives ultimately matter. However, like most things in leadership, making it matter is an unequal responsibility. Most of the responsibility is on the leader to explain, to encourage, and to inspire. If you are a leader, make it matter for yourself, for those who follow you, and for your team. General Dempsey had 32,000 soldiers with him in Baghdad in 2003 and 2004. Their job was to provide a safe environment in which Iraq's political leaders could restore confidence in their government and reestablish basic services like sewage, water, electricity, and trash collection. As that proved more and more difficult, an insurgency emerged, and Dempsey and his soldiers were among its targets. They began to take casualties in August of 2003, and as they did, they tried to remember their losses in two ways. It was their practice to begin each day with a morning briefing, and at the start of it they would display the fallen soldiers' names on the large screen at the front of the briefing room and pause for a moment of silence. As soon as possible thereafter, they would hold a memorial service with the soldiers' teammates at their forward operating base. Operating bases were spread across Baghdad. Very soon, General Dempsey became dissatisfied and unsettled at these morning briefings, with the thought that a lost soldier was remembered one minute and forgotten the next. He wanted something more enduring, something to hold on to. So he tasked his personnel officer to produce 2x4-inch laminated cards. Each card was carefully prepared to show the photograph and identifying information of the lost soldier. With these cards, Dempsey reasoned, he could carry them with him always. As time pressed on and casualties mounted, it wasn't long before General Dempsey was unable to carry all the cards with him at once. He decided he needed a place to keep them safe and found a mahogany cigar box for that purpose. Dempsey placed the precious cards, each bearing the memory of a soldier, carefully inside the box. Each day, he would select at random a few cards to carry with him so he could continue to honor those who had fallen under his command. He still does so. Eventually, the box contained a total of 132 cards, and the box itself grew to carry great importance in Dempsey's life. He decided that he wanted to engrave something on the box. But what? Most of us have seen images of military memorial services. A small wooden box, an inverted rifle topped with a helmet, a pair of boots, and the fallen soldier's dog tags. In the front row of the service sit the soldier's teammates. A chaplain provides a spiritual reading. The soldier's immediate supervisor, usually a lieutenant or captain, provides some memory of the soldier, and one or two of his peers, his surviving teammates, present a eulogy. And then taps is played. For General Dempsey, these were heart-wrenching experiences. Following each ceremony, those in attendance would pass down the row of the soldier's teammates to render their condolences and provide any encouragement they could muster. In the eyes of the fallen soldier's teammates, both fear and guilt were visible. Fear that they had to go back out into the environment that had taken their teammate, and guilt that while their teammate had not survived, somehow they had. In those early days, and for the first couple of these ceremonies, General Dempsey simply couldn't find the right words to help either himself or his young warriors. And then one early morning, In that contemplative, almost spiritual period between sleep and wakefulness, he found three simple words. The right words. The words that would later be engraved on his precious mahogany box. From that morning on, at the conclusion of each memorial service, when he would walk the line of the soldiers' teammates, Dempsey would shake the hands of the survivors of the fallen and tell them simply, "Make it matter." And each and every one of them knew exactly what the general meant. The box, with the phrase engraved across its lid, has been carefully and reverently placed on General Dempsey's desk as the commander of CENTCOM, as the commander of TRADOC, as the chief of staff of the Army, and as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He has since reflected that "make it matter" is a phrase that can and should hold meaning in all of our lives, regardless of occupation or status. Nobody wants to go to work each day and punch the clock. At the core of every individual is the desire to feel that the things that they do make a difference to the cause they believe in. And when people feel that the things they do make that difference, each individual contributor to the cause, mission, or vision acts decisively and confidently with his best foot forward. To make it matter is to provide meaning in the work that our team members are responsible for handling every day. The three most practical ways for leaders to pass on the belief that what one does for the organization matters begin with themselves, then focus on the team members, and end with the team itself. The ways leaders can make it matter include 1. Define and allow others to understand who you are. Leaders at every level must understand who they are individually and within the larger vision of the organization. In describing this, Mike Krzyzewski, head coach of Duke University's men's basketball team, notes that he doesn't want his talented athletes to leave their egos at the door of the gymnasium. He wants them to bring their egos in and learn to use them not just for themselves, but for the team. Coach K is right. As leaders, we should blend egos, not eliminate them. The knowledge of where you fit in the organization gives you strength, aligns your values, and encourages you to lead. The drive, passion, and energy you feel should be worn on your sleeve each day to model desirable behavior and as evidence of how one's individual purpose can coexist with the overall vision of the organization. 2. Make each individual feel that they have the potential to be a better person. By allowing your subordinates room to grow and fostering collaboration among team members, you encourage the entire team to use their work as a vehicle to the benefit of themselves and the organization. Moreover, if you can be a leader whom others want to emulate, your subordinates will understand what it means to be better people. General Dempsey was fond of telling his colonels, "If your subordinates don't want to grow up to be you someday, you're not doing your job." 3. Make sense of things for the team. It is the leader's responsibility to instruct, to coach, to hold accountable, and, importantly, to make sense of what's going on around the team as it seeks to accomplish its goals. Only when the leader shares knowledge can individuals within the organization understand where they fit. When General Dempsey took command of the 5,200 soldiers of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in 1996 at Fort Carson, Colorado, he found a unit unsettled by transition. They had recently relocated from Fort Bliss, Texas. Much of the leadership had changed during the transition. They had absorbed soldiers from inactivating units at Fort Carson. They were in an unfamiliar place and unfamiliar with the new leadership of the post. Compounding the issues brought about by the transition was the fact that it came at a time when the Department of the Army had become notorious for publishing numerous detailed, expansive, and mandatory instructions of things that had to be accomplished as a priority by unit commanders and soldiers across the Army. This was not the first time General Dempsey had seen this. In peacetime, everyone develops an opinion about when the armed forces will next be needed and to do what. Such was the case in 1996. Each headquarters at every level sought to reduce the risk of being wrong about the requirements of the next deployment by adding to the tasks required of subordinate headquarters. But, of course, as Dempsey knew, when everything is a priority, nothing is a priority. At the direction of its higher headquarters, the regiment had developed a mission essential task list that included a dozen missions for which the regiment needed to be prepared, everything from deliberate defense to deliberate attack, from hasty defense to hasty attack, and from movement to contact to the traditional cavalry missions of screen, cover, route, and area reconnaissance. In reality, there was not enough time nor enough training resources to be able to achieve proficiency in all of these missions. This left junior leaders very frustrated with senior leaders, who they felt were oblivious to the reality of reconciling competing priorities on a day-to-day basis. So when General Dempsey took command, the first question he was asked by the unit's leaders was how he would prioritize their activities. It was a fair question. But rather than answer it for them, and rather than take the list and simply place the tasks in some descending order of importance, Dempsey gathered his team leaders and asked them, "What's the one thing?" But they weren't exactly sure what he meant. "You know," he quipped, "like in the movie City Slickers, what's the one thing that will define your time as a leader in this regiment?" Dempsey explained that organizations that have identified the one thing most important to them, the one thing they want to do better than everyone else, know how to prioritize and on which elements of their business to focus. A few years later, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey would be asked by the President of the United States how the U.S. military could help address the emerging Ebola crisis in West Africa. Knowing the military's one thing as he answered the President's question led to the successful accomplishment of a very high-stakes and rapidly evolving mission. But more on that later. So, what's our one thing? Dempsey again asked his team at Fort Carson. With the input of every team member, they collectively determined what makes a cavalry regiment a cavalry regiment. Essentially, it's the ability to fight for, accumulate, and provide information to the corps commander, the three-star leader of approximately 45,000 soldiers. The cavalry regiment is the corps commander's eyes and ears, and the corps commander makes decisions about the disposition of his forces and whether to attack or defend based in significant measure on the information he receives from his cavalry regiment. With that as their touchstone, General Dempsey and his team developed the slogan, "We are all scouts." Within a regiment of 5,200 men and women are soldiers of myriad skills, including scouts, tankers, artillerymen, chemical specialists, logistics specialists, aviators, cooks, and administrative specialists. But for purposes of establishing their one thing, each of the 5,200 needed to understand that all of them were scouts. Whether on the front lines or in the rear, and whether cook or mechanics, from that point forward, they knew what was considered important to their regiment's understanding of the environment. They were scouts. With that settled, General Dempsey assembled a smaller group of key leaders to confront the lengthy mission essential task list. "Of all the missions on this list," he asked, "which most contributes to our ability to provide the corps commander with information?" The answer was the movement to contact. Military missions are determined by how much is known of the enemy about to be confronted. If a great deal is known about the enemy, location, size, armament, then a deliberate attack is the appropriate course of action. If less is known about the enemy and more information is required, then a movement to contact is appropriate. In this maneuver, the regiment moves forward with the smallest possible force, and as that forward vanguard makes contact with the enemy, the regiment reacts and adapts. With the proper training, and with the confidence that comes from understanding the commander's intent, the regiment adapts faster than the enemy. Interestingly, all movements to contact culminate in a transition to either a hasty attack or a hasty defense. By focusing on mastering the movement to contact, leaders necessarily gain a deep appreciation of those missions as well. For the 2 years he was in command, General Dempsey led the regiment in seeking to master the movement to contact. Anything else they were asked to do, they approached as an adaptation from their mastered task. A derivative of the one thing they knew unlocked their potential as soldiers and leaders. And by defining the purpose of the team, General Dempsey found a way to make it matter for every member of the regiment. The second principle of leadership, make it matter, works in conjunction with the first principle, give them memories, to build a culture for healthy, productive, efficient, and effective actions as individuals contributing to the purposes of team and the vision of the organization. Only those companies, groups, or teams that embrace these principles can expect to build an ethos that will lead their members to productively navigate through their tasks, respond effectively and efficiently to both high and low priority missions, and react effectively in crisis situations. As leaders, it is our responsibility to create and maintain this environment. Chapter 8. Think about what you're not thinking about. Leadership principle number 3. Learn to imagine. In team sports, what most often sets elite athletes apart is the ability to use their imagination in creating opportunities for themselves and for their teammates. Legendary hockey player Wayne Gretzky once attributed his great success to skating to where the puck is going, not to where it has been. University of Connecticut and Olympic women's basketball coach Gino Auriemma says that he looks for good passers before good shooters when he's recruiting players, because good passers see things that good shooters often miss. Imagining has something to do with anticipation and something to do with vision, but that's just part of it. Imagination is a learned attribute. It's some combination of training, experience, and eventually instinct that produces creativity in complex environments at the speed of teamwork. Not everyone will agree that imagining can be learned. Failures of imagination are common. In fact, after major crises, and even after many catastrophic successes, leaders will often say, "We never imagined that could happen." But leaders can learn to imagine if they place the emphasis on learn. If they learn to listen and to seek to know what the most junior member of their team knows. If they learn to be alert for weak signals and to avoid becoming complacent, satisfied with information affirming their beliefs. If they learn to find advisors who will challenge them, encourage them, surprise them. If they learn to connect disparate thoughts and to become uncommonly articulate. If they learn to challenge assumptions and to ask the right questions. If they learn to become comfortable with complexity and wary of simplicity. If you're a leader, you will need to exercise your imagination on behalf of your team, but learn first, and then you'll be able to imagine. Just like an elite athlete. When our organizations are presented with the issues that we are most prepared to solve, those duties for which we have long trained and prepared, for which we have documented processes and rule books and methodologies, our experience guides us toward resolution. We rely on carefully developed sets of tried and true procedures as we move forward in handling the issue. Conversely, when our organizations are faced with challenges for which we have no training or preparation, we may feel paralyzed by our lack of existing processes. It may be difficult to know even where to begin to bring the problem to its solution. Further, there are times when we feel somewhat prepared to handle an issue, but are aware that gaps in our abilities and procedures could have a great and negative effect on the outcome. We can have all the preparation in the world, but regardless of the robustness of existing processes, the high level of confidence we may have in our team's capabilities, or the assuredness we may have that a process that led to success in the past will continue to prove successful in the future, and especially if none of these are present, leaders in the new environment should begin by utilizing our third leadership principle, learn to imagine. As reiterated throughout this book, we as leaders must accept and understand that the environment in which we find ourselves leading today is constantly and rapidly changing, and the information we receive is affected by the digital echo. And this has a number of implications on how we run our organizations. It means that what worked for us before may not work for us now, that the procedures manual on which we relied in the past cannot possibly cover all the issues we will face in the new environment. It also means that our roles as leaders are continually increasing in complexity as the challenges we face become vaster and more diverse. Some of our roles are changing at their core with the appearance of new technologies. And lastly, it means that instead of executing tasks as experts in our fields, we will be asked to solve problems that we may feel only somewhat able to handle. We will be responsible for carrying out tasks and completing missions for which we have no experience whatsoever, and with a lot at stake. It doesn't mean, however, that our existing processes are no longer relevant. The procedures manual is still valid and still houses useful information by which our organizations operate on a daily basis. Regarding our roles themselves, it's not that they're becoming too great, that we cannot learn new technologies impacting our industries, or that we cannot find and execute real solutions to the different challenges with which we are presented. And it definitely doesn't mean we need to go gain more experience by enrolling in yet another graduate program or taking a lesser position in order to learn how to navigate these tasks. The solution is that when faced with any task, whether routine or extreme crisis, we must first imagine the possibilities or learn to imagine in order to determine exactly what our team's goal should be in order to solve the problem. Well before Ebola became a national issue, General Dempsey listened to the advice of his staff surgeon, Major General Nadja West, to begin learning about the disease. An expert in her field, she predicted with considerable accuracy that the Ebola virus would have massive implications, and though few others in Washington were discussing the disease at the time, she urged General Dempsey to pay attention to it. West recommended he not only learn more about the disease, but also convene a team of experts to discuss how the U.S. military might contribute to a broader government campaign to help control it. The military was very busy at the time. General Dempsey recalls feeling torn between following West's advice and sticking with some of the more immediate and pressing matters on his plate. He knew this wasn't something in which the military would necessarily become involved. He knew he could deflect suggestions that it should become involved. After all, it was not an inherently military mission. General Dempsey knew, however, that the U.S. military possesses unique organizational, logistical, and training capabilities that would be urgently needed should a crisis erupt. So, Dempsey, along with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, decided to put together a planning team to determine what part of the task would be most appropriate for the military. They would need to know what resources were readily available and how long it would take to prepare them to deploy, and they would need to identify the opportunity costs to their other commitments around the world. As anyone in business or the military is aware, our organizational ecosystem is affected when we must pull resources to handle a crisis situation. In addition to the research on preparation and costs, Dempsey gathered experts on infectious disease from academia and from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as intelligence and State Department experts on West Africa. He also brought the military commander in Africa into the discussion so that he would learn along with the team. As General Dempsey's staff surgeon had predicted, the Ebola epidemic ultimately escalated to the point of crisis and threatened to spill over into the homeland. The president convened his National Security Council to assess the situation and determine if there were options for government agencies to contribute to its resolution. The military was ready. General Dempsey and his team had already gained the knowledge they needed. They had established relationships with those who would carry the biggest share of the task. They had consulted with two of our European allies who had similar interests in West Africa. They knew what they could contribute, how quickly, and at what cost to their missions elsewhere. Because they had imagined a future where their one thing would be required, they knew how to apply their resources, and especially their knowledge, to this particular situation. Dempsey and his team presented their well-developed case to the president. I suggested that military medical personnel were trained for myriad medical challenges, including infectious disease, General Dempsey recalls, but that pulling significant numbers of medics from within the armed forces would create a readiness problem. The president agreed with the concern and asked if the team had come up with any other options. Of course, they had. Rather than using its own medical staff, General Dempsey offered that the military could provide what was most lacking in the crisis and what the American Armed Forces do better than anyone else in the world, set up an operations center manned and equipped to process and share information, establish a transportation hub to monitor and coordinate the flow of logistics, and establish a training base for the hundreds of international medical volunteers eager to assist in the crisis. In other words, the one thing the military was best positioned to bring to the fight against Ebola was a forum for coordination. The president agreed. To jumpstart the effort, the Army deployed the two-star commander of U.S. Army Africa from Vicenza, Italy. Later, he would be replaced by a two-star commander of division headquarters from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. The Army envisioned an effort of approximately 2,500 soldiers. Their marching orders were to facilitate coordination of the effort to fight Ebola, to provide an operations center, and to establish open and transparent relationships with U.S. and international relief organizations. They would assist in the management of logistics, construct a training facility, and provide training to medical personnel in how to operate safely within the Ebola hot zone. They established a single limiting principle as their way of articulating risk. No U.S. military personnel would enter the Ebola hot zone, defined as the interiors of facilities actively treating individuals with the virus. With that guidance, the two commanders deployed to Liberia and accomplished their mission. The military provided those things it can bring faster and better to crises than anyone in the world: coordination, logistics, and training, and empowered those in the task force to adapt within the intent and limiting principle articulated. They accomplished the Ebola mission without degrading their readiness elsewhere. The third leadership principle, learn to imagine, refers to creative problem solving and the ways in which leaders should work to reimagine how their team's abilities can be strategically utilized in a variety of conditions. As leaders, we must avoid assuming that the first answer is the best answer. We cannot blindly follow existing procedures simply because they have worked in the past. Our environment is changing too quickly, and our challenges are becoming too complex. We must reach beyond our regular lines of thinking and acting, rethink the ways in which we can apply our team's abilities, and empower our people to help us define the paths to success. Chapter 9. Prevent Decision Paralysis. Leadership Principle Number 4. Develop a bias for action. In one of many clever moments in Alice Through the Looking Glass, Lewis Carroll depicts Alice running hard but remaining in the same spot. Alice is both exhausted and exasperated. The Red Queen, lounging under a nearby tree, is amused. Alice looked round her in great surprise. "Why, I do believe we've been under this tree the whole time. Everything's just as it was." "Of course it is," said the Queen. "What would you have it?" "Well, in our country," said Alice, still panting a little, "you generally get to somewhere else, if you ran very fast for a long time, as we've been doing." "A slow sort of country," said the Queen. "Now, here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that." Footnote: Lewis Carroll, Alice's Adventure in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, 1871, New York, Bantam Classics, reissued edition, 2006, pages 134 to 135. The year was 1871, and in this scene, Carroll was alluding to an evolutionary theory of the time, which posited that organisms must constantly adapt and evolve to survive while pitted against ever-evolving opposing organisms in an ever-changing environment. Sound familiar? If the Red Queen was right about how fast we needed to adapt in the 19th century, what would she say today? As a leader in today's environment, you may not find yourself responsible for the outcome of an ongoing evolutionary contest, but you will find yourself responsible for the outcome of a contest for the success, the trust, and the confidence of those who follow you in an ever-evolving, ever-changing environment. And to prevail in that contest, you need to develop a bias for action. A bias for action is a leadership instinct based on the belief that in order to decide, you must learn, and in order to learn, you must alter the status quo. A bias for action is a leadership instinct that mitigates decision paralysis and helps you avoid the endless pursuit of that one exquisite piece of information that seems to be all that stands between you and clarity. A bias for action is the recognition that, in our complex world, learning is active and iterative. We act, we assess, and we act again. A bias for action is the recognition that facts are vulnerable and that speed matters in the era of digital echoes. A bias for action won't solve all of your leadership challenges, but it will energize your organization, keep you alert to both vulnerabilities and opportunities, and illuminate the often hidden cost of inaction. The military has a saying, lead, follow, or get out of the way. That's a bias for action. In a well-known anecdote about Albert Einstein, he is quoted as saying that if he had 60 minutes to save the world, he would spend 55 of those minutes understanding the problem and 5 minutes fixing it. Many past leadership theories have echoed Einstein, encouraging leaders to carefully analyze problems before taking action. Contemporary leadership theories, however, must understand the changing nature of time and how it affects us as leaders and the decisions we make in our organizations. Faced with a sea of data, ever-multiplying technologies, and the digital echo, we have a tendency to halt all motion so that we may back away from situations and try to understand all their moving parts. We develop insatiable appetites for information and sometimes absurd desires for more, read better, options to present themselves so we can be certain of our decisions. We mobilize our teams to cultivate more and more information, hoping that the perfect solution exists among the clutter. But how much time are we willing to spend on research without action? And will the research still be valid by the time we are ready to make a decision? What do we do with all of that information once we have it? How do we sort through it? And how can we tell a bad solution from a good one, or a great solution from a crazy idea? As a leader facing an issue or crisis, we may have a sense that a dichotomy exists wherein we must either A, sit back and analyze the issue and its potential solutions, or B, seize control of the issue immediately by taking possibly misguided action. We always want to be sure we are making the best, most informed decisions possible, and we do all we can to avoid acting in ways that will be detrimental to our team or the organization. 9 times out of 10, an intelligent leader will analyze a situation before taking a broad, sweeping action that may be catastrophic to his team or organization. Why push forward when you may hardly understand what the most desirable outcome might be, let alone what steps the team needs to take to get there? But leaders cannot allow themselves to become paralyzed by a search for the perfect answer while information flows and technology updates at ever-increasing speeds. Leaders are now facing scenarios that require action in the moment, before significant changes can occur in the environment, and before we can possibly fully analyze the problem. The longer we take to respond to catalysts, the more our environment adapts, and the less we understand about the issue and how to solve it. So we must act quickly but intelligently. In March 2004, the 32,000 soldiers of General Dempsey's 1st Armored Division prepared to transfer responsibility for security in Baghdad to the soldiers of the 1st Cavalry Division. General Dempsey and his troops had been in Baghdad for a year, and it was time to go home. Home, for most of them, was one of several bases in Germany. An advance party of several thousand soldiers had already been sent back to Germany to ensure that barracks and motor pools were ready for the arrival of the larger group of soldiers. Family members were planning welcome home ceremonies, and some were making travel arrangements for the vacations they would take when their soldiers came back from Iraq. Others had received orders for follow-on assignments in the United States, and they would begin out-processing following block leave. A ceremony marking the completion of the transfer of responsibility from General Dempsey and his 32,000 soldiers to the 1st Cavalry Division was scheduled for April 7th at the large Crossed Sabres parade field in Baghdad. But in preparation for the switch, hands had to be changed across Baghdad neighborhoods up to 2 weeks prior. Commanders of 1,000 soldier battalions and 3,000 soldier brigades from the two divisions worked together to complete a checklist of activities necessary to certify each transfer. Relationships with Iraqi security force partners, local governing officials, tribal leaders, and religious leaders were carefully passed. Specialized equipment was transferred. As battalions completed their transfers, they began the long convoy to Kuwait, where their remaining equipment would be sent back to Germany on ships. Hundreds of soldiers were moved to Balad Air Base, north of Baghdad, where they would fly home on Air Force aircraft. In the midst of the changeover, General Dempsey's division was spread among Baghdad, Kuwait, Balad, and Germany. And on April 4th, less than 72 hours prior to the completion of the transfer of responsibility, it all fell apart. Shia militia in Baghdad and Iraq, along with Sunni insurgents in Al-Anbar province, staged an uprising against their provisional government and against the U.S. troops stationed there. General Dempsey's division learned that the highway they had been using to supply their forces from Kuwait had been severed by Shia militia. In the eastern part of Baghdad, Sadr City was in flames. West of Baghdad, Fallujah was under Sunni insurgent control. They soon realized that Baghdad was isolated from the rest of the country. With Iraqi sovereignty expected to be restored to a newly elected government that coming June, it wasn't only the division's timetable that was put at risk by the uprising. The entire mission in Iraq was at risk. In the early morning of April 4th, General Dempsey walked out of the back of his headquarters, located in the center of Baghdad International Airport. To the north, he could see the dark black smoke of 12 evenly spaced oil fires. a sure sign that a U.S. convoy of 5,000-gallon fuel trucks had been ambushed. From the east, he could hear the unmistakable sound of a firefight. He knew that to the west, the Marines were embroiled in a tough fight with Sunni insurgents, and that earlier that morning, two bridges across the supply line to Kuwait had been demolished, effectively blocking the highway. General Dempsey was also well aware that the coalition had no forces in reserve. All of the forces in Iraq were committed to other geographic responsibilities or to other tasks, except for his forces. The soldiers and leaders designated to replace them in Baghdad had arrived. Dempsey still had more than 10,000 soldiers of 1st Armored Division in Baghdad in various stages of transition and another 2,000 or so in Kuwait. He knew that in an emergency he could recall the soldiers already home in Germany, and he had 2,500 exceptional scouts of the 2nd Light Cavalry Regiment from Fort Polk, Louisiana, still attached to his division. Anticipating what he knew would soon be asked of him, to remain with his troops in Iraq for several more months to quell the uprising, Dempsey first had to stop any further movement south to Kuwait and by air from Balad. Fortunately, his two deputies, Brigadier General Mark Hertling and Brigadier General Mike Scaparotti, were at his headquarters that morning for a review of the division's progress toward redeployment. The three huddled. "We've got a few challenges in sorting all of this out," Dempsey told them. "We know it's becoming increasingly likely we're going to be told to stay in Iraq longer, but no one is going to tell us that until it's approved all the way to the White House. We also know that if we stop our redeployment convoys and flights, it will signal to both our soldiers and their families that something is wrong. But if we don't stop these movements, we may not be able to regroup quickly enough to get back into the fight in time to make a difference." Complicating matters even further was that in the early months of the war, one of the division's sister units had been extended, and it had caused a significant and embarrassing morale problem that had gained a great deal of media coverage. Neither the Army nor the Department of Defense wanted a repeat of that incident. Furthermore, making a decision to keep soldiers in Iraq beyond 12 months was a big step for an administration that was counting on the mission ending, not extending. The trio knew that the politics inside and outside Iraq were hypersensitive at the moment, and that they would be expected to await instructions before doing anything to change their mission. They also knew that every passing hour allowed the militia to become further entrenched in the key cities of southern Iraq, and the population to become intimidated. The complexity and speed of the evolving crisis argued for them to act. So they acted. They decided to stop the movement of soldiers to Kuwait and to suspend flights from Balad based on the increased risk caused by the uprising. General Dempsey informed Lieutenant General Rick Sanchez, commander of coalition forces in Iraq, that he was suspending the movement of his forces and would reevaluate the decision daily. Dempsey explained that he knew the difficulty Sanchez faced in determining how to deal with the uprising and let him know that Dempsey, along with the other leaders of the 1st Armored Division, were assessing what it would take to regroup to provide Sanchez with options. Dempsey asked Sanchez for a quick decision on whether the division would remain in Iraq so that he could communicate with his soldiers and their families. For many reasons, he didn't expect a quick decision. Fortunately, General Dempsey was previously scheduled to meet with the CENTCOM commander, General John Abizaid, the next day. He would be attuned to options that might exist outside Iraq, and, importantly, to issues in Washington that might impact any decision. So Dempsey called Abizaid's executive officer to give him his assessment and to give Abizaid notice that he would be seeking guidance the next day. After another late-night discussion with his brigadiers, Dempsey scheduled a meeting of all battalion commanders, brigade commanders, and their command sergeant's major for the next day following his meeting with General Abizaid. Meanwhile, the situation in Baghdad had become worse. The Marines needed reinforcements for the fight in Fallujah, and the only other Marines in Iraq were tied down south of Baghdad in what later became known as the Triangle of Death. General Jim Mattis called General Dempsey to ask if the 1st Armored Division could extend south of Baghdad so that he could take those Marines to join the fight in Fallujah. Dempsey told Mattis that he could and would make this recommendation to both Lieutenant General Sanchez and General Abizaid the next day. Further south, in Karbala, Wasit, Diwaniya, and Najaf provinces, the Shia militia had taken over provincial government buildings and were threatening the United States' Polish coalition partners. Due to Polish government caveats, the Poles, who are good fighters, were limited in what they could do. Specifically, they could conduct defensive but not offensive operations. If offensive operations were to be conducted to restore control of these three provinces to Iraqi government control, it would have to be U.S. forces conducting them. When General Dempsey met with General Abizaid, they compared assessments of the situation. "It's bad," Abizaid began. "The provisional government of Iraq is fragile, and at home, this will be a serious setback. I know you're already aware that we may need you and your soldiers to stay here until we stabilize the situation, and I know how tough that will be on your soldiers and their families. I need to know if you can do it." General Dempsey appreciated the question from a leader who was always attuned to the human dimension of warfare. "We can, sir," Dempsey responded. "But to do it, and to keep faith with my soldiers, I need three things. First, I need to keep the unit together. Don't parcel out my battalions and brigades to thicken things elsewhere. If you keep us together, we'll respond together. Second, I need you to give us a mission. Don't just keep us sitting in Baghdad. Give us something to do. And third, most importantly, let me entrust my soldiers and their families with information. If they hear about this on CNN before they hear it from me, we'll be in trouble." "Do you have a mission in mind?" Abizaid asked. "I do, sir," Dempsey replied. "Release the Marines in South Baghdad to Jim Mattis and give that sector to me. Besides the South Baghdad mission, task me to restore control of Karbala, Wasit, Diwaniya, and Najaf provinces. Give me authority to coordinate with the Polish forces to our south and assist them in dealing with the Shia militia and keeping our line of communication to Kuwait open." "How long will you need?" he asked. "We can get it done in 90 days, Dempsey said. General Abizaid nodded. "Okay, Marty. I can give you two of those three right now. We'll keep your unit intact, and we'll give you the missions you suggest. As far as getting ahead of the Pentagon with letting your soldiers and their families know what's happening, just use your judgment. God bless you and your troops." En route from that meeting to the one with battalion commanders, brigade commanders, and their command sergeants major, General Dempsey called his two brigadiers from his vehicle. "Okay, men," he said. "Turn the division around." The rest of the ride, General Dempsey prepared himself for the next meeting. He knew that bringing back soldiers who had already redeployed home would be extraordinarily hard on them and on their families. His next call would be to his wife, Dini, to share all of this with her. She would have a huge role to play in making sure that the families were on board and would be cared for during the extension. Dempsey knew that the families back home would already have an instinct something wasn't right. In these times of ubiquitous communications, Dempsey knew that, in a way, we bring our families to war with us. The meeting with his battalion commanders, brigade commanders, and command sergeants major was one of the most memorable experiences of Dempsey's long career. It was a group of about 75 senior leaders. Everyone knew what was coming, and the tension in the room was palpable. General Dempsey spoke without slides, images, or maps. This was to be a conversation with his family of the past year. He began by describing the situation as they understood it. He explained that the entire mission was at risk. He reassured them that their division had accomplished its part of the task, pausing to reflect on the fact that they had lost almost 100 soldiers during their time in Baghdad. Dempsey explained that they were about to be asked to do something both very difficult and truly extraordinary. "We are going to be asked to turn the division around. to bring more than 1,000 soldiers back from Germany to reconstitute a force that was almost out of Iraq and get it back in the fight to restore control of southern Iraq to the government of Iraq. Dempsey acknowledged that this would put enormous pressure on them as leaders, but expressed his certainty that if they approached this challenge as they had every other challenge over the past 12 months, then this event would become a glorious part of their unit's history. General Dempsey told them that it wouldn't be right to have sacrificed so much over the past year to expel one tyrant just to see him replaced by another form of tyranny. He acknowledged that their families would take this news hard. He told them that he intended to send Brigadier General Mark Hertling back to Germany the next day to meet over the course of the next week with the families on each caserne. He told them that the USA REUR commander, General B.B. Bell, had promised to break down the barriers to help the families recover deposits, alter plans, and adjust airline reservations. He told them that they would decide, they and their families, whether this would be a positive or a negative moment in the division's history. He informed them that none of this could be made public until the Pentagon announced it, but that he wanted them and their families to hear it from him and not from the news media. General Dempsey finished by asking them to keep the information among themselves and told them he was proud of them. There were questions, mostly about the mission. Dempsey explained that they had three tasks, that the tasks were very different, and that he would count on each of them to continue to learn and adapt as they accomplished them. The 2nd Light Cavalry Regiment would move to Wasit, Diwania, and Najaf provinces and recapture them from the Shia militia. The 2nd Brigade would move to southern Baghdad and take over responsibility for that sector from the Marines. The 1st Brigade would move to Karbala and Babil provinces to conduct offensive operations to restore control with the Polish partners. General Dempsey told them that there would be an ongoing and parallel political negotiation among U.S. diplomats, Iraqi government officials, and Shia political leaders that, at times, they would need to support. They would meet their objectives when the provisional government of Iraq's appointed officials were restored to authority, when the Shia militia in southern Iraq had disbanded and its leaders were back within the political process, and when the Sunni insurgents in southern Baghdad were no longer capable of contributing to the fight in Fallujah. General Dempsey noted that over the past year, this group of men and women had developed a remarkable rapport. He told them that he expected them to collaborate with one another in the execution of these new missions, to crosstalk and share resources, and to make decisions within his intent. "Don't wait for me to approve every movement or adaptation you need to make," Dempsey told them. "Keep me informed. Let me know if you need something that only I can provide, and I'll do the same for you. It won't do us any good to accomplish 2 out of 3 of these missions. We need to work together to accomplish all 3. The next day, Brigadier General Mark Hertling returned to Germany. There he teamed with Dini and with General B.B. Bell to empower spouses with the information they needed in order to understand why this extension and the mission were so important. These 3 were able to build and sustain trust among the division's leaders and their families. The extension didn't generate a single negative media story, despite the fact that these families would have to continue to sacrifice and the division would continue to take casualties. It wasn't until 3 days later that the Pentagon announced the extension. By that time, everyone in the division and their families had been notified. In Iraq, General Dempsey's other deputy, Brigadier General Mike Scaparotti, was busy reconstituting the division. Equipment that had been wrapped for shipment in Kuwait was unwrapped. Convoys were returning to Baghdad, and personnel were reintegrated with their units and were prepared for combat. General Dempsey would travel from unit to unit across Baghdad and make his own assessment of their readiness. At one stop, he was busy explaining why this extension was so important when a young staff sergeant interrupted him. "With all due respect, sir, you don't have to explain all of this to us. We've been through a lot together, and we trust you." Moved by these words, Dempsey decided the division was ready. The staff sergeant went on, "So, sir, if it's all the same to you, you go on and do what you have to do, and we'll get about the business of doing what we have to do." General Dempsey swelled with pride. At another stop, another sergeant told Dempsey of a conversation he'd had with his wife on the phone that morning. The sergeant was apologizing to his wife for missing his daughter's high school prom and graduation and his young son's soccer season. His wife scolded him for apologizing and told him that she had been to Brigadier General Hertling's briefing. "You need to concentrate on your mission and getting home safely. We'll take care of business back here," she said. Empowering the families with the information necessary for them to understand the task at hand had been the right thing to do. 90 days later, General Dempsey's division had accomplished its new mission, and they once again prepared to head home. They had lost another 40 soldiers during the extension. All losses during the deployment were tragic, these last 40 especially so. There are many lessons to be taken from the 1st Armored Division's actions between April and July 2004. They made it through this period because they worked together to achieve clarity of purpose, unity of effort, shared power, constant communication, and, most of all, trust. They didn't do everything right in Baghdad during this deployment and its extension, but during the dark days of April, when asked to do the inconceivable, they acted, and they mostly got it right. Rarely in organizations do we find ourselves at a standstill or in a position in which we simply carry out daily tasks without facing problems or crises. Issues may be low priority, affecting very few people in very minor ways, or they may be full-blown, all-hands-on-deck threats to the organization. In General Dempsey's case, it was sending 32,000 soldiers back into war. In the new environment, leaders must understand that in order to assert and sustain power both in steady times and in the face of great challenge, their organizations need to maintain a proactive mindset and treat every catalyst with a bias for action. The immediate actions we take in response to catalysts need not always be dramatic, but some action is almost always required. As leaders, we need to ask ourselves, what can we do right now to make an impact in solving the issue, sometimes without fully comprehending where that action may lead? In order to interact with the new environment, though, we need to change and evolve along with it, rather than attempt to fight it. We need to act based on the information we have, not remain immobile, waiting for better options to emerge. If we adopt a mindset whereby we act, assess, and then act again, we can steadily work toward conquering the challenges we face. Actively engaging with issues to influence their outcomes early before they evolve in ways that may prove even more counter to our interests is paramount in the new environment. We need a bias for action, not only to be decisive in our reactions to catalysts, but also as part of our overall strategy in building and sustaining our power. Without it, companies and countries alike will simply be outpaced. Chapter 10. Collaborate at every level of the organization. Leadership Principle Number 5. Co-create context. General Dempsey is a Jersey boy, or at least he was. So, as he left beautiful and historic Congress Hall in Cape May on his way back to Washington, D.C., he wasn't surprised at the volume of traffic he soon encountered. Fortunately, when his chosen route became congested, Waze offered him an alternative. His fellow travelers, several hundred of them, were sharing information on how he might get to his destination faster. They were co-creating the context of the decisions he was making about his trip. Decisions are always made in some context. As a result, they produce second and sometimes even third-order effects that inevitably affect future decisions.